All right. So let's just spend a few minutes making a few general ha'aros about the sugya, rounding out our introduction. And then I want to spend some time developing an important analytic framework for thinking about the issues in our sugya here. So I want to spend 5 minutes now just rounding out the introduction that we spoke about in the last year. In terms of the mechayev, so we saw Rabbeinu Bachya, this idea that maybe this din has to do with the poel is misasik v'torach v'peirosav, and im lo hayelo afsha lechol b'heter yochal b'iser. So the Torah had to be matir, the right of the poel. It wasn't totally clear to us what kind of din this is in Rabbeinu Bachya. If you look at the Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Tav Kuf Ayin Vav, did anybody get a chance to review his formulation of Mishar Shei HaMitzvah? How he understands this? You can look at it now. He says, Mishar Shei HaMitzvah Olamed Es Bnei Yisrael Lios Lahem Nefesh Yafe V'Ratzon Tov Uve Emes Shehadiktok Im HaPoel Shelo Yochal Bashir Hu Amel Be'odo Hu Amel B'davar. Very interesting formulation. So, precluding or being exacting with a poel to the extent that you don't let him eat something that he's working on while he's working on it, or something that he worked to produce while he's producing it, all the more so when it comes to agriculture. Sha'adam sameach bo, sounds like there's some just intrinsic pleasure one derives from planting. I don't know if you read Anna Karenina. Isn't that the point that Levin just finds meaning in his working with the people in the field to harvest the produce? No? Cole, haven't you gone on this Russian literature?
Not till I'm taking a break from Tolstoy. Itamar, your sound is also dipping. Your sound is dipping in and out.
Oh, I'm sorry. How's this?
Maybe you're covering the speaker. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So the 1 second. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I'm sorry. My sound was dipping out. If my sound dips, then let me know. All right. Okay. So you get here in the Sefer HaChinuch, this idea in Mitzvah Tav Kuf Ayin Vav, he says, "V'emesh adiktok im apoel shelo yochal ba'asher hu amel ba'odo hu amel b'davar, v'kol shekein k'shein osin b'gedulei akarka she'adam sameach bo." He thinks that it'll be even more problematic to withhold this from a worker who's sameach in the thing that he's working on. He says, this would be more sheyesh hora b'zeh al hanivala v'al mezeg ramot. It would reflect like really bad midos on a person who does this, person who prevents the worker from benefiting from the thing that he's working on. So what do you think of that? I mean, what do you think just of the mechayev here? What do you think of the mechayev here?
I mean, in a way, it's weird. You're not necessarily even consuming what you're working on. You're consuming the pre-processed food.
Well, it's not just the, what do you mean you're not consuming what you're working on?
I mean, you're saying it's how poorly reflects on, I guess, the owner of the land of Baal Bias. He's preventing the workers from, you know, benefiting from that which they're working on, but not really consuming what they're working on. They're consuming the pre-processed version of what they're working on.
Well, I mean, if they're harvesting grapes and they're allowed to eat some of the grapes that they harvest, then they're actually benefiting. They would be benefiting from the thing they're producing. Right. So I'm not sure about that point, but I agree with you, Adam, that the emphasis here seems to be on like the virtuous character traits of the employer rather than the rights of the poel. Is that the sense you get from the chinuch? Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's that, Adam?
Yeah, definitely get that sense.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, that's interesting to me. why he focuses more on cultivating the features, the virtues of the employer, rather than thinking of like, well, this is something that the Poel's entitled to. So I thought that formulation was quite interesting. But notice he does say that it has to do with, he has a nice explanation for why it's limited to the thing that the Poel's working on while he's working on it. Because that's where like the real wrong lies, right? It would reflect really bad character traits to not allow him to benefit from the thing that he's producing while he's producing it. And he thinks that Gidule Karka is significant just because of this, he thinks there's this natural joy or utility or feelings of goodness that a person gets from successful planting. I don't know if any of you tried a vegetable garden in your backyard, but you know,
are you reading Adam Sameach Bo? This is probably not so significant to the point you're making, but are you reading Adam Sameach Bo as the Poel is Sameach or the Baal HaBayis is Sameach?
Yeah, I thought he's talking about the Poel.
Okay. I thought it was about lice, but
because of Ibirchas Hashem Asher Nasamlo?
Yeah. And then it reflects badly that like he doesn't want to share his simcha with the people that are working to help him achieve it.
It's interesting. What do you think? You guys with Yakir on this?
Yeah, that seems like the better reading.
I like your reading it more, just because like what's the connection? We've been talking about the Poel. Like what's the significance of the simcha? Like we're focusing on the simcha of the Poel here, that the Poel is happy and feels fulfilled. So it would that the withholding the peros would reflect that poor approach.
That's what's motivating my reading. The Kol Shekein seems to think that, right? It makes the withholding, the eating right, worse when it's something that an adam is sameach. But why should the simcha of the Baal HaBayis make the dikduk in Poel more egregious?
Because of like the simchas yom tov, simchas kreso type arguments. When you have a bracha from Hashem and you're sameach on it, it's worse to hoard it.
Okay, that's interesting. I can hear that. I'd want to think more about the readings. Zacharia, looks like you have.
Yeah, going back to the Oduhu Amel B'davar, it was a little strange because the Chinuch follows the Rambam, who has a really strange reading of the Chermesh Lotanif, that he views it as an Isser to eat at any time other than Gemar Malacha, as in the sense of like, when the worker can only eat once he literally finishes the whole job. So I'm not sure what he's reaching for here. As in, I thought Aki was actually kind of emphasizing that, like, that the worker never has a right to eat, but Odo Hu Amel. I don't know. There might be more of a technical distinction that he's not referencing here.
Well, I think the idea is that you could be Odo Amel Bigmar Malacha. So it's not Gmar Malacha is about the pre being at Gmar Malacha rather than you finishing your.
No, you're right. That's like the standard approach to the Rishonim. The Rambam just views it like he sticks in the word like, oh, Enam Ochlin El B'Shas Malacha. He reads the Mishnah as Enam Ochlin El B'Shas Gmar Malacha. And
he thinks and you don't the think entire. And you don't think that's referring to the pre?
No, as in he has this whole kind of wild Shita, the Raifa takes his task on it.
Okay, we can talk more about that Shita, the Rambam. You think the Chinuch here is going to be.
I mean, he literally says it two mitzvahs later that he thinks there's an Isser to eat while you're working. Okay. Like he thinks that there's more Isurim on the worker than Heterim.
Okay. We could talk about that. We'll see if they're consistent. But I think what's striking to me most about the Chinuch is this idea that it's about cultivating the virtuous dispositions of the employer rather than the basic entitlement of the worker. Something we'll talk more about. Notice that in Rabbi Nebachia's formulation speaks more from the side of the Poel's entitlement. The Torah is matirit for him because it would be impossible for him to resist it. And I think you might think that this might tie into the different formulations we saw in the Rishonim. If there's a mitzvah on the Baal HaBayis, lo haniach es ha-poel lechol, right? Is the is the point here for the Bala Bias to basically waive the basic right that he has to his own crop yield? Right, so the Torah is saying, look, Bala Bias, do the right thing here. Be meniach es apoel lechol, which would make sense from the Chinuch's point of view, or whether you think it's just a basic right that the Poel himself has, totally separate from the Bala Bias. And we saw different formulations in the Rishonim on those lines. Good, so that's what I wanted to mention from the Chinuch. I just wanted to call to your attention another possible Mechayiv here, although it's not directly related to our Sugya, but you'll see other Rishonim related. The Ravid in earlier in Bava Metzia on Lama Beis thinks that Sar Bali Chaim could be Del Raisa, and he thinks that Chasimas Losafsam Shor Bedisho could be a possible Makar for Sar Bali Chaim Del Raisa. If you connect, as the Sugya does in several places, the Isser of Losafsam Shor Bedisho with the Isser, with the Mitzvah of Achilas Poel, you might think that Achilas Poel is grounded in a concern of Tzar Bali Chaim, if you connect those up. The Ravid himself doesn't. The Ravid just connects. He just thinks it's implied in Losafsam Shor Bedisho. But if you make the connection that the Sugya makes, arguably you could think that the Mechayiv here is Tzar Bali Chaim, which again is not inconsistent with the formulation that Rabbi Nabachia has. Now, I just wonder, do you have thoughts on whether it makes sense even to apply Tzar Bali Chaim to the case of Achilas HaPoel? The Ravid only has it in the instance of Losafsam Shor Bedisho. Anybody have thoughts on whether it's an appropriate extension, whether it's reasonable?
I think you could even say
there's a related principle.
Go for it, go.
Right? Doesn't the Gemara say there's a related principle? You have to sustain the, what's the line? Yeah, exactly, right. So that's a similar idea. It's not like direct drasha.
Well, mitzvah lachioso is more about making sure his basic needs are met, right? Sar Bali Chaim is about the psychological anguish that he's going to have from producing the stuff, being in its presence, and not being able to benefit from it.
Right. I don't know. I thought Tzar Bali Chaim was about. Okay, I mean those aren't. I mean, it's Tzar. It's like Tzar is not necessarily psychological. It's not psychological in Bava Kamma always.
But look, the shore not being able to eat isn't causing it any physical pain.
Well, yeah, it is. It's depriving it of food.
Yeah, I thought it was. So that's the whole point.
But it might not be the whole point, but it is certainly part of the point.
I always understood is that like no, it's cruel. It's like it's wagging a steak in front of its face and then
yeah, it's also so cruel. But like, why is it cruel? It's cruel because you're not letting it fulfill a biological need. As a result, it has psychological pain. But fine, these are all related.
Anyway, even if your ox is perfectly well fed, and you give it three hearty meals a day, you still have there's still a requirement of low sock.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about whether low socks applies.
All right, case. Fine. I mean, I think the assumption is right. If your dog is full, probably not.
But I was wondering, maybe Adam or Gabe? Adam has a hand, then Gabe?
Yeah, I mean, there's a fundamental question, I think, of when you can compare the issue of Sar Bali Chaim for an animal and person in general.
Excellent. Flush, that's what I was wondering. Flush that out for me, Adam.
I mean, like, it comes down to, like, Mishnah later on, like, we instruct people not to be gluttonous in their work and to eat everything. It's like, yeah, you can tell a person and people can learn to, you know, withhold that desire over time. An animal can't necessarily learn how to do that.
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting point. Meaning, is Tzar Bali Chaim as a concept applicable to persons, to humans, right, Adam?
Yeah.
Right. You might think that kind of that uncontrollable, let's call it like a humane Tzar, the fact that, you know, the animal is sitting there and it can't really. Its sense of distress, appreciate that there's, you know, some contractual exchange, you're compensated to do this work, and that's what disentitles you to eat from it. that's unique to the animals, as a tsar bali chayim, but it wouldn't apply to like a person who, you know, has the capacities to maybe control those emotions or psychological distresses. So yeah, that's what I was wondering exactly. Whether even if there's this halachic or conceptual relationship between lo sachzom and achilas poel, could you squeeze tsar bali chayim through that nexus? And I think Adam's giving us a good reason to think maybe not. Yeah.
I think so in terms of the comparison we're making between this and Rabbi Rebbecha, I think if you could actually split it according to like two of the Hofeldian principles.
Okay, hold off on Hofeld. We're going to talk about Hofeld. Okay, so yeah, we'll talk more about Hofeld in a few minutes. Good. Gabe, looks like you had a comment you wanted to make. Were you going to make this point?
Yeah, I was going to make that point, I guess, just to further one more step, given that the poel is contractually a contractual laborer, right, he knows where his next meal is coming from. The whole notion of a salary is that you're compensated for your work and you feel like you've earned your next meal, whereas you couldn't apply a similar construct.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Gabe. That's very much what Adam's getting at also. Yeah, I think that's a very nice point. And I think that's important for us to consider whether tzar bali chayim is an applicable concept to, is it a predicate that really would apply to achilas poel?
It's almost demeaning to apply tzar bali chayim to the worker in this context.
That's right. I mean, he should be able to realize like what the terms of the employment are and what he's entitled to and what he's not entitled to. Yeah.
I would just add, though, that wouldn't the tsar bali chayim be more on reflecting on the Baal's mindset? So regardless of the fact that, yeah, the worker couldn't learn and know better, if it's still a cruel action being performed by the Baal, it would still apply. Like, I think the assumption is that tsar bali chayim is linked to the actual ability of the person getting hurt, but if it's about mandating a certain moral character from human, then doing something that's bad or mean wouldn't really change whether or not what it's acting on.
Yeah,
or the person is.
I think, like I put in the chat, the beginning of like it's not like the chinuch's Shoresh Amitza for all of these, like the Tachsom and Shiloh HaKain is all humanity focused. That it's like I think that the Ravid's not that far off from, if not maybe the strict halachic interpretation of the Chinuch, definitely the moral idea of it, that like you have a responsibility to do, to like, it's like forced chesed kind of like don't like to like you need to go beyond maybe what's strictly required of you because it instills a sense of yasharness. So I think that Evan's response to Gabe is perfect. I don't necessarily think it's demeaning if we say that you have a responsibility to not inflict suffering on another living being, whether it animal or human.
Yeah. Interesting to consider. I think we should think about this a little more when we see the connection in the sugyas between the two, whether that would pull us away from tsar bali chayim or not. But yeah, I think this is exactly what we have to consider. I want to just take one more minute to look at the Rav Hirsch. So I take it, there's a lot of back and forth about this Rav Hirsch. I take it that the way Akir's been running with it is that this last line here is the most important, right? Al saf shlita sa adam al teva b'shah hanot el aholir es machshava anochi ez ashali v'shali bavad mifazer es toras Hashem ez zari hachuva. So is the crucial point here that you might think, you know, so the kind of idea is that the capitalist landowner is going to think it's mine because it's my karka, and the poel is going to say it's mine because it's my labor contribution. And the point is the Torah says, ha, it's neither of yours, right? Or it's diffused, it's no one has absolute rights to it. And that's to show what he says earlier in the piece. Kasher Yisrael Hashem as this social national entity of the Jewish people, who shamar la'atzmo zechus shlita bilti mugbelas al kol rechushenu. You know, to show that no person has full sovereignty or absolute dominion over these things. And so the Torah like just splits the property right between the two of them. Is that your interpretation, Yakir?
A little bit different. I wasn't sure that the Zeshali Vishali Bilvad was being put into the Poel's mouth also, but I think it could make sense that way for sure.
Right. I mean, you're saying is that her is more worried about abridging the landowner's property claim. And the Poel's like the Hechatimzi, right? This is why you thought it worked nicely with like Yisi Ben Yehuda. You know, even somebody who just happens to be walking through the Sadeh would have an in-principle right to it.
Yeah.
I have to say, I would have kind of said like, so Rav Hirsch wants to say like at the moment where, all the investment of the landowner is culminated, in the picking of the apple, right? And the Torah comes and says, it's not really yours. It belongs. So I guess I don't view maybe it's just like a matter of which perspective you view it from. I guess like the way I read the halachos, more likely it's the opposite. It's not that the owners, I'm giving the musar shmooze to the owner. It's that the worker has in fact like earned a quasi property right to this item. That's at least the discussion that the Gemaras seem to be having later on in the Perek about do you have to like put your full back and arms and legs into it or can you just carry it on your shoulders? Is it related? Is it a form of compensation or is compensation have nothing to do with it? Those are all, the big chakira in this Perek is this a quasi property right or is it a form of compensation? And I just don't think that's like, it's not like the Torah is saying, it's like quasi hefker. It's saying, no, like the Poel has the Poel is himself kind of an owner.
That's how I was reading it yesterday. At least I was pointing to certain. Right. Yeah. I agree with you, Paul. Meaning I think that that's a really fruitful way of thinking about.
You think that's what Rav Hirsch is saying?
No, I don't think, I'm not sure.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think Rav Hirsch goes strongly in that direction at all. He doesn't say, the Poel labored on it, and therefore he has some affirmative property right in it. But I agree that from just the reading of certain parts of the Sugya, that could be an important theme. That's I think that might be one of the strong Mechayvim here. But I think no one that I've seen has tapped into that interpretation. But I think
said what I just said.
Correct. Even though I think that would be like a very natural way to read the Sugya.
Yeah, I just think it's natural.
Yeah,
I think that's.
I mean, correct. Yes, I agree. So I want to try to see if we could find better evidence for that view because it just seems very very intuitive, and borne out by the Sugyas. Okay, I want to talk about a few other parts of the Sugya very briefly. So I want to go back to the formulations in the Rishonim. Remember, we saw different formulations in the Ramban. So the Ramban, in his Hakdama, he said, "Sheyochal hasachir min hamechubar she'osibo." I think this is clearly a permission, not an obligation. Right? The Poel doesn't have a duty to eat from the thing he's creating. I think it's permissible. It's a license that the sachir can eat from the thing that he produces. Here, I just want to remind us all of Hofel. Did anybody get a chance to, first of all, Zach and Evan and Adin, have you looked at the Hofel stuff? No, you're not excited to.
I looked it over last year. It's the same stuff you sent out last year, yeah?
Yeah. Adam, you were in the Chabura last year for Hofel last year, right? Right. Let me just make one.
I missed Hofeld.
Oh, you missed Hofeld. I came right after.
But I know the basic Hofeld talk.
Okay, good. So I want to just mention one distinction here. We could talk more about Hofeld in greater length at a different time. So does everybody see the Stanford Encyclopedia here that's on my screen? Is that shared with you? Okay. So just remember that Hofel distinguishes between different kinds of rights. And this is, right, he's saying if you think about rights, there could be different kinds of legal relationships that the word rights can express. The word rights is just ambiguous. Mernelstein's back, okay. So Hofeld says there's something called a right that's just a liberty or a privilege. And he says what that amounts to is if you have a privilege to phi, if and only if A has no duty not to phi. So for example, you have a right.
Phi is Greek for, is a Greek letter that here refers to just like an action.
Yeah, to do something. So the idea is that you have a right, you say that you have a right to pick up seashells on the beach, right? What kind of a right is that? So Hofeld says that right is a mere privilege, meaning you have no duty not to pick up sea. You owe no one a duty to forbear from picking up a seashell. Now that's very different from the different sense of right that Hofeld points out, which is a claim right, which correlates to somebody else having a duty to do something to you. So a contract between an employer and an employee confers on the employee a right to be paid her wages. That's not a liberty, right? It's it actually generates a correlative duty in another party to do something to you, right? To pay your wages. So A has a claim that B phi, if and only if B has a duty to A to phi. So the important point here is that claim rights correlate to somebody else having a duty, but liberties correlate to a no duty, right? Or you yourself owe no one a duty to not do the thing you want to do. That's a very important distinction between two different senses of rights. Wanna come back to our sugya. There you go. I want to come back to our sugya. When you look at the language in the Rishonim, I think that's exactly what's going on here. The Rambam in Hilchos Schirus in the Koteret is clearly referring to Hofeldian liberty right, Hofeldian privilege. Sheyochal hasachir min ha-mechubar she'osebo, it sounds like the poel is under no duty to not eat the peros that he's working on. It's like the seashell case. You have a right to pick up the seashells. The poel has a right to eat the food. What sense of right? In that he owes the Baal HaBayis no duty to not eat it. It's a permission. I think when you look at the, it's interesting, when you look at the Rambam Hilchos Schirus, you get a slightly different sense. Here it's Hare al Baal HaBayis mitzvah, sheyaniach osan lecha mimasha hin osin bo. Slightly different emphasis, that the Baal HaBayis has a duty and obligation not to interfere with the poel taking the food.
I don't know. I just signed back on, so if I'm repeating anything that's been spoken about before, just mute me. But I would point to the famous disagreement or famous work by Robert Cover, where he articulates his idea that Jewish law, like the concept of mitzvos, kind of necessarily precludes like a rights discourse that we usually presume, which I think you're kind of like inherently disagreeing with here by comparing this like Hare al Baal HaBayis mitzvah, which we could see as like an obligation, like vis-a-vis God, not necessarily a duty to another person. I once brought this up to Tony Cronman, who's also a Yale law professor. And he, I think, probably pulling on Hofeld, like, disagreed. He was like, I don't understand what Cover's talking about. Every obligation means that someone has a right on me to, like, yeah. But I think that there is, like, a conceptual framework for disentangling these two things.
Yeah, right? Good. We actually spoke about Cover last year. My view is, yeah, I think Hofeld, so I'm with, you said Cronman?
Cronman, yeah, Tony Cronman.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with him. I think that's right. The correlativity here, you know, it correlates to the right and the other party.
But it is like a relevant question to ask, like who's enforced, like presumably, like, if we look at it as a legal right, it means that there's like an enforcement mechanism, right? Like, I come to Beis Din and I say, you owe me these, right? Like, I think that that's like conceptually, that's like second level, right? It's like God says, this is your mitzvah, right? Like, celestial spheres, the things that like make the, I don't know, klipos go away, like whatever metaphysical attributes we are going to like attribute to a mitzvah, is distinct from like the then second level rights that a.
Yeah, so I'm not as convinced, Shua, because, you know, the Torah clearly sometimes imposes duties owed to other people, right? That's kind of like the, we spoke about this last time, unless you reduce all mitzvos ben adam lechavero to logic of ben adam lemakom obligations. But the idea is that no, ben adam lechavero means like the duties are truly owed to other persons, right? So tzedakah, the debt, the obligation is truly owed to the poor. In the case of kibud av v'em, like the obligation of kavod is, it's a duty owed to the parent.
But in any of those, I mean, maybe this is a tangent, though it seems to me to be very appropriate, but like, I think if we took apart any of those examples, people could disagree about how much of that duty is actually vested in a, like, for example, whether an ani can force you to pay tzedakah as a sugya, right? The pashto says that no individual person can be tovea your staka, right? Because your
Machane Ephraim thinks the ani can be tovea.
I only know Tosfos and Balbastra. I don't know about Machane Ephraim. But
you spent less time in Yale Law School and more time in the Beis Medrash than you've
known. That's for sure true.
Spend more time in the Gush and less time in Kerem Biav.
Then I wouldn't know Tosfos. You're right. I just think that there's like, right, like breaking that down is like an essential part to figuring out what like a language like this Rambam means, right? Like if it's a mitzvah essay, then that's like, to me, that's like an obligation qua God, not like the second level corollary of a right that someone's being tovea from you.
It's interesting. Okay. So you're saying when the Rambam here says mitzvah she'aniach, right, it's not a duty owed to the poel, right? It's just a...
Yeah, whether or not they eat, I'm assigned my mitzvah.
Yeah, okay. So that's a good important qualification. When we say, Toshu is pointing out, Ariel Balabais, mitzvah she'aniach losam lechel mimasha hinosin, a duty to allow the poel to eat from what he's consuming, is that a duty owed to the poel? That's what Shua is pointing out, right? And I guess conversely, the nafkamina is whether you think the poel really has a right against the Baal HaBayis to be allowed to consume the peiros, right? Good. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. I want to also draw attention to the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos, Mitzvah Seh Reish Aleph. Here, look at the Rambam's formulation. Mitzvah Reish Aleph, Hishet Sivanu. This also takes a stance on Shua's point about cover. Shetzivanu lios hasachir ochel be'es avodasa me'adavar sheyavod bo. So there's really, who's the, right, is this a duty-based mitzvah? Is it a rights-based mitzvah, meaning at least a liberty right, not a claim right? Right, so hishetzivanu lios hasachir ochel be'es avodasa me'adavar sheyavod bo. I take it, what do you think this means? What's your best stab at interpretation?
Like, lihiyot is a powerful verb to choose there, which makes it more, seem a little bit more like a claim right. I think you could read it either way, but like that it is like kind of like the mahut of the food is that like it is in his like area or under his dominion, kind of.
Well, I don't know. Like, not that mahut. I don't know about the essence of the food. I think he's just saying that there's a commandment. Doesn't say upon whom, right? So who's the? Is there a duty bearer here in this mitzvah? Who's the duty bearer of the mitzvah? Gabe.
What we're struggling with here is applying the language of mitzvah to Hofeldian privileges, right? It's kind of like, what are other examples of mitzvot which are privileges, not duties?
Yeah, good. I think we could.
I don't think this is a privilege.
You don't think, Cole?
Isn't a privilege the ability to change the situation?
Gabe, I just want to say that I think that it's totally compatible to have a mitzvah that just generates a privilege. I think this is. I think this being one of the best, arguably a really good example, right? See, the way I read this Rambam, it's that this exactly pushing back on Cover's point that Shu has mentioned. Cover's point is like, oh, if everything's a mitzvah, that means it's all duties. But that's not the right way to think about mitzvos. Mitzvos are just like the rules. It's not that every mitzvah is actually an obligation. It's not, right? It's not that every mitzvah generates a Hofeldian duty. Mitzvos are like power conferring rules in some cases. And so here the Torah says, the mitzvah is that a poel, I would say, have a license, lios hasachir ochel be'es avodaso mehadavar shayav, that the sachir have permission, that he's licensed to eat from the thing that he's consuming, that he's producing. So I take it that Sivanu is like, yeah, this is the rule on Klal Yisrael, that the poel has this permission, this Hofeldian liberty.
Yes, yeah, so I agree with that. I just think one of the reasons we're struggling here is because it doesn't really matter which angle we come from. The Rambam has come from three different angles, or sort of has three different formulations, which don't all say the same thing, but all create the same societal norm in which the poel has the privilege to eat from the produce he's working on.
Yeah.
But then that's what on any one specific party, which is why the language of mitzvah doesn't fit perfectly with the formation of a mitzvah, of a state in sefer mitzvahs.
Well, I think it's fine for a mitzvah to just be a rule, right? The Torah says, this is the commandment, meaning obey this rule. The rule being that there's a Hofeldian liberty for the poel to eat mishel habalabayis, meaning he owes the balabayis no duty to not eat from it. I think Sefer HaMitzvos Reish Aleph is consistent with the Koteret, Sheyochal HaSachir Min HaMechubar, which I think is also a Hofeldian liberty. The question is, what do we do with Schiros Yudbeis Aleph, Harei HaBal HaBayis Mitzvah Sheyaniach Osan Lechol Mimasha Heinosen? I would say, I think that's not a Hofeldian claim, right? Meaning, it doesn't mean that the Poel has a right to demand that he be given food. He just has a right that the balabayas not interfere with his liberty right. Right? Meaning, it's like I have a right. People say this, for example. Let's say I have a liberty right to use the street. Meaning I owe you no duty to not use the street. Arguably, you might owe me a duty not to interfere with my liberty right in some cases. So there's like a claim right protecting the liberty right. And I think that's what's going on here. So for example, the real mitzvah is a liberty right, a Hofeldian liberty, a permission that the poel has to eat the food. But then it's like buttressed by a duty or by a claim right that the balabayas not interfere with that liberty use. I think that's the way to make sense of what's that, Shua?
I don't know that I have a coherent thought. I'm just like, this is it's. I think that you're for sure right about the focus being, at least in the Rambam, on the sacher. I don't know about calling this like a right that buttresses it. I think it like necessarily has to be a right that's born out of it, and it's like a kind of like it's not its own separate.
It's a logical consequence.
Exactly. It couldn't have existed. The original Sacher's right can't exist without this. Memela, this is like necessary, but not that it's in like an additional piece. And I'm also like, from a categorical perspective, I'm just like really struggling to figure out how this is a mitzvah essay. Like, do we have any other example of like a mitzvah essay that, that just like creates creates an inability for someone else to stop you from doing something.
Like a Hofeldian liberty.
Yeah, sure.
Good question. What do you think, guys? It's a very deep question about the nature.
Well, an obligation not to interfere is an obligation, no?
Well, hold off on that.
That would be a los hace, right? You're not allowed to do this thing.
Right. That's what I think.
You're saying because it's a yaniya. I mean, I don't really like.
Well, focus.
You're saying
on
this is an ase that requires an omission. Yaniach is like an omission. Is that the? This is an interesting.
I mean, what else?
What are the stakes of this?
If you went to Isha Sifas Tawar, right? It's but I guess there it would really reduce to like certain. That's interesting. You have mitzvahs ase like dine shomrim, right? So there's a mitzvah ase which is just like din shomer, and that's
right.
Not just the mitzvahs ase is not just the.
It's not a tzivoy. It's just a legal framework that the Torah institutes. That's
right.
More or less defeasible depending on your views of that sort of thing.
That's right, and this is one of the reasons why I'm skeptical about Kaber's claim that. Because like we have the word mitzvah, that we think of it in terms of duties.
Well, Cover's claim isn't global.
Yeah,
I have to say, I think Cover's. I texted the. I sent the WhatsApp. I Cover's claim is that, I think is that a lot of it's obviously not for everything, but Cover's claim is that a lot of, a lot. Of the halacha is concerned with what individual people have to do for no one in particular. So, the classic rights obligations framework is some kind of contract. Arguably. In the case of torts, where there is no prior legal relationship, we still conceive of the fact that, like, I have a right against everybody's interference in or damage to my own property. So a counterpart of that kind of, like, general right that I have, which I guess is a liberty. So there are claim rights and liberty rights. Well, there are claim duties, and then there's some counterpart to a liberty duty that's like a duty that you have generally, just as a right, just as certain property rights or rights that you have generally, like against everybody. I don't know what the right word for that is. It's the inverse. It's the mirror image of a liberty right. That's what Cover's talking about. I think that has enormous explanatory power. In the halakha, because there clearly are plenty of things that we have to do.
Right, that's fine.
Yeah. What would you call that? Let's come up with a name for that.
There's a term. Goldberg and Zapersky, like they're like legal theorists, they call them just simple directives. Simple directives are just right. They're not owed to anyone. Things like that. Simple duties. Simple directives. I think if that's what you're getting at. Cool.
Okay.
We can talk more about it. Yeah.
Okay. That's what Cover means. Okay.
So, but I think, so this is one important point where I think Hofeld's, I think it's totally right that the Rambam here is talking about mere permission, a liberty right. We'll see why this becomes more important for specifying the content of the mitzvah in a few moments. I want to draw us to another Hofeldian distinction, which also will help us clarify the nature of the mitzvah. So remember, if you read the second Hofeld article, he has this really important distinction between primary rights and duties and secondary rights and duties. So the idea is that I have a primary right to my property, and you have a correlative duty not to interfere with my property usage, right or not, something like that. But then if the primary right is breached, or if the primary duty is breached, that will generate a secondary set of rights and duties, like to pay me compensation, right? So first you have a duty not to violate my property rights. Once the property right is breached, once the primary right is breached, that's going to generate secondary rights and duties, like a duty to compensate and a right to compensation. And sometimes you could test the nature of the primary duty by seeing what secondary rights and duties are generated by the breach of the primary one. Remember, we saw this last year, we saw this in the case of poelim in contracts. So like, what does the breach of a work agreement give rise to, right? Like a right to compel the worker to finish the job, or just a right to compensation. And we saw actually Machlokes Rishonim along these lines, right? So since there was an interesting question, like what actually is the primary duty that's owed? Now, I think in our sugya, you find this on Daf Pei Ches Amud Beis. The Gemara here, again, draws an analogy between the Baal Bayis and the Poel. It says, Kinafshecha, remember the Pasuk used that phrase, to teach us the Chidatanya, Kinafshecha ma nafshecha im chesamta pater, af poel im chesamta pater. Sounds like bidieved. If you did violate the Poel's right, so remember the Rambam said, mitzvah lahaniach lepoel to eat. Suppose you didn't allow him, right? Suppose you just prevented him from eating his peiros. Do you owe him some form of compensation? So the primary duty is breached, right? The right of the poel was violated. What does it give rise to a secondary duty of compensation? Is this that kind of a right that it could generate a secondary duty to compensate? So the Gemara here is actually not so clear. The Gemara says, ma nafshecha im chesamta pater af poel im chesamta pater, just like if you were to muzzle yourself, you wouldn't owe yourself any compensation. So too, if you were to muzzle the poel, you don't owe him any compensation, which is pretty interesting. What does that mean? The Tur, when he quotes this, he says, poel ha'osa malacha la'bal habayis, hareza ocha mimashehu osa, etc., etc. Umiyu, im chasmo shelo lachol, pater. If you were to stop him from eating, you're exempt from paying him anything. Upirish Rashi, bein im katzatzimo shelo yochal, bein shechasmo bal karcho. This is true whether you made a stipulation with him that he wouldn't be allowed to eat. So even though there's a mitzvah on yach lepoel sheyochal, you contracted around that. Or if you were chosem him bal karcho, you actually like physically prevented him from eating. But then he says, v'davka le'inyan malkis ka'amar, she'u pater, aval yisura ika. There's some isser in doing so. Im chasma bal karcho. Okay. And then he cites the Rama, v'chin kasev ha'rama, de bal karcho lo matzi le'michsamei, you have a duty to pay him compensation if you muzzle the worker against his will. So this is quite interesting, right? If to my mind, the question is, if this is just a mere Hofeldian liberty, right? Just it's a mere permission that the poel has to work. It's not the case that he has a claim right to the actual fruits. It's not that he has some property right to the, it's not that these things are his, that the Baal HaBayis has a duty to give them to him. He just has a mere license to eat them, right? It's like you show up at a wedding, you have a license to eat the food there. Suppose somebody were to, you know, lock you in a room for the wedding. Do they have a duty to compensate you for the food you would have eaten? I don't know. It's an interesting question. Here, what's interesting to me is that the Tur cites the Rama's holding that this breach of the Poel's permission to eat would give rise to a duty to compensate him, seemingly to the food that he would have eaten. Anybody, what do you think? I mean, you can see the Sma, by the way, commenting on the Rama here. This is the Rama, but the Rama in the Shulchan Aruch says, V'yaseh l'chos mosh lo yochav im chos mosh lume mishalim lay.
What's the havamina that you get malchus? Again, it's a mitzvah essay, I thought.
Yeah. It's the connection to lo tafs on shor b'disho.
Yeah.
Lo tafs on. But we don't have to worry about the malchus question. I'm more interested in, like, what's the compensation? Right.
I thought the grower was bothered by this exactly, and he thought that you only get paid if we made an agreement. Okay, you get to eat $20 worth of food while you're working, and then I prevent you. As in, once I've monetized it, and I guess that changes the nature of what kind of claim you have.
Yeah.
I mean, like, obviously it's impossible to really understand for sure what the grower meant, but that's how I read it. That katitsa meaning you made a deal that he can eat X amount, and then you prevent him.
Good. Yeah, I think that's very possible. I'll just say the Sma, we'll get to the grounds, the Sma says, you're chayav to pay kishir shehaya ochel. Like, you see how much the guy would have eaten, that's your duty to compensate. It's pretty interesting that would be the secondary duty that is generated by the breach of the primary duty. The Gra here is a little complicated. The Gra here, my reading on Shimon and Zion Bay's Vim Chasmo, is Chasmo al yedei ktitza or bidyeved, meaning like you actually stopped him from eating, maybe. Zachariah, how are you reading the Gra? You're reading Vim Chasmo, then Shlumin Alimle.
Yeah, he's saying that only Chasima, so in a typical case, if I hire a worker Stam and I muzzle him, I don't have to pay. If I hire a worker and I'm kotsets a certain amount of achila, and then I muzzle him, I have to pay.
Right.
It's kind of uninteresting.
Oh, no, he's directly deflating it, as in he doesn't think it's correct. That's exactly what he's doing.
Oh, I'm
sorry. Right. I mean, he's just saying that the Gra denies, the Gra's saying my point, meaning the
yes, exactly.
Yeah. So Zachariah, just tell me if I'm getting this right. So Zachariah is saying that according to the Gra, the mere liberty right to eat from the Baal HaBayis could not on its own generate entitlement to compensation, right? There's no duty to repair, or there's no thing to repair, right? You just took away this liberty that you had. You didn't take away the fruit that you own. Sympathetic to that, and he said, I don't know. The only time it could generate a duty to compensate is if there was some ktitza. Like there was some, I guess, contractual understanding that I'm going to work for you and I'm going to eat this amount. And then if I deprive you of that amount, I have an obligation to compensate. That's how you're reading the Gra.
Itamar, the Sma and the Gra are having our disagreement. Yes. Not our disagreement. The thing that we said a few minutes ago. Meaning if you're the only reason that this line in the Shulchan, take the Gra away from it. The only way this in the Shulchan Aruch makes any sense, this psak that you're owed compensation in the Shulchan Aruch really makes sense, is if there's some independent right to the achila that what makes more sense. You could come up with a fancy argument about how, well, there's a slot in the compensation that's like specifically, you could imagine a view that's like, well, you know, you're owed monetary compensation and you're owed fruit compensation as part of your salary, as part of your wage. Correct. As a worker. That's possible, but I think we would all agree a little bit awkward. More likely is that, no, you have an independent non-contractual right to the fruit that you help produce. It's low sachsim in that an employer who muzzles a worker is in that case not far from a gazlan, and is preventing you from making use of property that's rightfully yours. As a result, you deserve compensation. That's the way the Sma reads the Shulchan Aruch, for sure. The Gra, I agree with Zachariah, has this deflationary reading of the Shulchan Aruch that, I mean, you know, I'd love the Gra on my side, but that's just frankly, it seems not what the Shulchan Aruch had in mind.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. You know, I'll just add, I gave as a point, I'll take it in 1 second. I just want to say that, you know, one way you might think of this part of the question here is whether the primary right is an actual claim right to the payros, right? Like as working, I have a right to these payros, that you have a duty to give them to me, et cetera, et cetera. Or whether it's just like a mere permission, meaning the poel has no duty to not eat the payros, it's a license, but interfering with that mere license wouldn't say like, oh, you owe him now a duty to compensate him for like the fruits that were his, or something along those lines. Gabe, you have a comment? And it looks like Shu also has a comment. Wants to make.
Yeah, just to bolster what Cole called the awkward position, that maybe this is actually contractually stipulated. So the source for this discussion, which the graph points to in Tadi Aleph Amud Aleph, Rav Papa says that, at least talking about the Shor B'tisho, that B'shas Mashicha Yichayv Leib Mizonos Eha, that the time of Mashicha, the Chiyu Mizonos Escha, which sounds much more contractual than anything we've said so far. And at least according to that strain of thought in the Gemara, the Chiyu of Tashlumen stems from a contractual obligation, not so much a sort of privilege or right to the poem.
So you're saying to motivate the Gra's idea that there's like there's a moment when there could be co-states, these damim?
Yeah, well, it motivates the Gra, but I think just more generally, the reason there would be any kind of chiyuv tashlumin or secondary, secondary right.
Yeah.
Is because this Zchut Achila is actually built into the contract more broadly, more formally. I'm not sure if the way to read that is to say, well, the Torah creates a reality in which the Paul has Zchut Achila, so then we write that into the contract, or the Din Torah mandates that we make this part of one of the contractual terms. But something along those lines.
Totally. I think that's right.
I don't understand the Gruz.
One second. I would say, imagine I go to a wedding and, you know, you do something that stops me from being able to eat. You interfere with my ability to eat at the wedding. You owe me, it seems strange to think that you owe me the sushi that I would have eaten at the smorgasbord, right? You don't think that interfering with somebody's eating in that kind of a case, that's a mere Hofeldian liberty, right? Meaning I have a license to eat at the Shmorg. Interfering with that, now you have a duty to buy me sushi. It just seems wrong, right? That doesn't seem correct. It would only be a case where I have some like fundamental claim right and entitlement that you interfered with. That's the kind that would generate the duties to compensate.
Itamar, do you have the same intuition about like, it's interesting the case you just brought up. Do you have the same intuition about prohibiting somebody from, or obstructing somebody from making use of the commons? Like you might say that you have no right to eat the sushi at the shmorg anyway. It's just about, what?
Your Zoom's like a little off. I think it's a little delayed. But yeah, if you block somebody from using the commons, right? Same kind of, that's the question, right?
That's an interesting, right? You have no right to be at the wedding. You're only at the wedding because the Cohens threw a wedding. You have no right to go to the Cohens' wedding. And they don't even like you anyway. No, it's just that you're related to their cousin. Right, yeah. You know, you were just one of the cousins. Sorry.
That's right.
But you do have a right to use to let your sheep graze in the, it's interesting, are you owed compensation for having your liberty, if somebody obstructs your liberty, or is your claim a claim without an addressee? Like that would be a problem.
Exactly. That's part of the issue. Correct. By the way, I think there's an interesting question. You tell me what you think. What happens if a third party other than the Baal HaBayis interferes with the Poel's Achila's chos? You know, notice in these cases it sounds like this is addressed to the Baal HaBayis. We also lechosmo shelo yochal, v'im chosmo shlumim mishalim way. Is there any indication that it's wrong for a third party to be chosing the poel? Those guys are standing there blocking not letting the poel grab the fruits. It's an interesting question. This goes back, I think, to the Rambam's formulation. Maybe there's a unique mitzvah al habala bias lohaniach es apoel. Let's just go back to that formulation for a second. Hare al balabayis mitzvah she'en yachos am lecho. But is there an obligation on a third party to allow the poel to eat? Cole, did you have a point, or you're screaming at some putznik?
Was I like mouthing things?
Yeah, I think so.
I think I was insulting an editor silently. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's fine. But so you know, you might think that if there's a unique duty imposed on the Baal HaBayis lahaniach es apoel, then only the Bala Bais breaching this duty could generate a Chiyuv L'Shalim, whereas a third party who interferes with the Poel's Zechus Achila couldn't have such an obligation. Does that make sense? What do you think? Shua, does that make sense to you? Or?
I'm still processing. I think that you're like descriptively it makes sense. I'm just not sure what it means. Like for the actual, I don't know, most of the mitzvah. Like I think that like framework works to explain why it's true that you would have to pay or not. But I'm not sure if it tells us anything like deeper about this actual idea.
Okay. I wanna move to one other point. And this is gonna introduce the last major point I wanted to raise today. We can talk about these efficiency considerations later. You know, the Gemara, probably the most important question that the Gemara raises is this question of whether the Poel is Ochel Mishelo or Mishel Shemayim. You know, it's one of these Gemaras that introduces this really lumdisha distinction, and then you're not, you know, the Gemara doesn't really bother to tell you what the actual distinction is, but the Gemara seems to be getting at something really important here. So it says on Sadi Beis Amud Aleph, Yiboyelu Poel Mishelo Ochel Mishel Shemayim Ochel. There's a great Chakira. The Gemara says, L'may nafkamina, what would be the distinction between the views? The nafkamina is whether the Poel says, don't give, instead of my taking the peros, I want you to give it to my wife and kids. You know, this is like sometimes like schools do tuition remission, right? So like, let's say you were to work for Turo and Turo says, we're paying you $100,000. But instead of us paying it to you that you have to pay taxes on it, we'll just cut out a check to your kid's school for, you know, pay their tuition. So you get the, you know, you get the tax difference as a benefit. So here the Poel says to the Bala Bais, like, look, I don't need to eat while I'm working. Let my wife and kids, let them, you know, give the food to them rather than to me. So that's what the Gemara thinks is one nafkamina. Iyarmis mishalo hu ochel yahavin amehu. If the Poel is considered to be entitled to these things, or he has some claim right, let's say, like some property right in these things, then he has the legal power to tell the owner that just transfer it to my wife and kids, right? It's mine. The way I want it to be, the way I want this duty to be satisfied is by giving it to my wife and kids. But Ela Yarmis Mishel Shemayim Hu Ochel Liti Dei Zachi Le Rachmana LeIshto Ubanav Lo Zachi Le Rachmana. If the entitlement is much narrower, it's Mishel Shemayim, then the Poel has no power to assign it to his wife and kids. Very, very lumdish and fascinating position of the Gemara. But I want to just mention, I want to flesh out two concepts here that I think are quite important. So the first is this idea of tenu l'ishti u'banai. That, just the descriptive thing, the way to characterize that is as a Hofeldian what? For our Hofeldian
privilege?
It would be a Hofeldian power. Right, so a Hofeldian power is to change the rights and duties that other people have in the thing, right? So the idea is that this is mine. I have a power to transfer it to somebody else. Why is that called power? Because when I transfer this glass to Zacharia, I'm now changing the
duties
that come along with it, right? So I generate a new right in Zacharia. People owe duties to Zachariah. Oh, that's a Hofeldian power.
What?
I'll just give you the example. No, that's here.
You're not creating a relationship. You're just
here. For example, Cole, a Hofeldian power is the incident that enables agents to alter primary rules. A has a power if and only if A has the ability.
No,
to alter
I
or another.
I understand what you're saying.
So for example, let me just give an example.
I'm disagreeing with what you're saying.
Okay, just one second. A ship's
the wife and the wife and son don't thereby gain a right. The right's totally parasitic.
Well, that's not true. It's like a full transfer. If I say, make the check out to my wife and kids, then I'm now, I'm altering the...
Revoke? I have a question. Can he revoke it? Can you revoke it?
Arguably not, right? Well, the point is, let's put it this way, Cole. Let's put it this way. I've now generated a duty in the, for some reason, your Zoom is not working. Just get, you have to have the airways catch up with you. It's a Hofeldian power because I'm now altering the Hofeldian incidents in others, right? So if I work for Zacharia and I say, Zacharia, give the Anavim to my wife and kids, I'm now imposing a Hofeldian duty on him to transfer it to my wife and kids, and I'm generating a Hofeldian right to my wife and kids to the Anavim that they didn't have previously. So it's a Hofeldian power. The example is, for example, a ship's captain has the power, some people, it's a right, some people refer it as a right, to order a midshipman to scrub the deck. And so I have the power to order the employer to give the payros to my wife and children, right? In doing so, I impose a new duty on the balabais. So that's a kind of Hofeldian power. And so the Gemara seems to be asking whether in my zchus achila, do I have this power, this Hofeldian power to transfer it to others? And the Gemara thinks that depends on whether you're ochal mishalo, whether you're ochal mishal achirim. Okay. Got it. Shua, that's your message from Cole. Well, I don't know if it's just saying that who the beneficiary should be. The question is, does he have the legal power to force the balabais to recognize the new beneficiary?
It right? depends how much this goes through the balabais, which turns on questions we asked before.
Yeah, exactly, Gabe. I think it's exactly related to that question, right? But maybe say a little more on that, Gabe.
Meaning, if the Baal Bais, it depends. Let's take the two formations of the Rambam. If the Baal Bais needs to provide or allocate the fruit for the poel, then I think you're right. This is a power. But if it's rather, and I think this is the Gemara's suggestion, if it's Mishalo, if somehow these fruit are granted to the poel, and the poel just decides who gets to eat from the fruit, which are rightfully his based on the labor that he's done or the right of the Torah. And then I side with Cole.
Yeah, the question is, can he assign the right to the third party? That's right. That seems to be the question.
No, yeah, but he's not really forcing the ball by his hands in the second formulation.
On the second formulation, you think he's not, right, because he doesn't have the power, right? The point on the second formulation, he can't reassign the right to a third party. Right? I mean, the idea is that, like, when Shua invites me to his wedding, I can't say, oh, send the invitation to Gabe instead, right? He's giving me, like, some sort of zchus to come to the wedding, but it's not the kind of thing that I have a power to assign to a third party. Whereas on this other legal relationship of Mishalo, where there's some sort of entitlement or claim right that I have, arguably comes along with the power to transfer it to a third party, right? I mean, nothing hangs on the formalism of Hofeld. The Gemara thinks that the characterization of the Poel's entitlement, what kind of right he has, is going to determine whether he has the right to the power to transfer it to a third party. That's what I want to take away from this Gemara right now. All right? Anybody have thoughts? Shua, you have thoughts?
It's just not my, this framework is just not how I would read this Gemara if I were reading it in a vacuum. And so I'm just trying to reassess my preconceptions, right? Like if I were learning Bo Metzia without Hofeld, I would see this as a discussion about whether or not I own the payros or I have a right to eat the payros, right? Like that's the distinction that I see, right? Yeah, Mishalo Ochel, it means that the mitzvah says they're mine, and the Yamar Mishal Shamayim Ochel, that the mitzvah says I can eat, but they're not mine.
Okay.
And that's just like, that's a that I think is different than what we're saying now.
So that's an interesting question. Is that different from what we're saying now? Shua says, the real hakira here is whether you just have a right to eat it or do you own it, right? Correct, Shua?
Yeah, right. And just to, I mean, to give back up my eighth grade reading of this Gemara, right? Like, that's what mishalom means in Nezikin, right? Shalom Roshuso, like it's very much used as like a reflection on like property, like things that are mine.
Okay, excellent. But I would say Shua, that it's more precise. So when we say is it yours, that doesn't really mean much in and of itself. This is the point I want to flesh out even more. The significance of something being yours has to be cashed out in terms of the specific Hofeldian incidents that come along with it being yours, right? So what rights, powers, duties, and liabilities do you have in the object? And so the real question here, everyone agrees that the poel has some right to consume. The question is it just a right to consume, or does it also come along with a right to transfer? Is it the kind of right that generates a duty to compensate when it's breached? I don't think much is gained by throwing in the word ownership. Let me motivate that very quickly for a second, just to respond to Shua. So I encourage everyone to take a look at this article that I sent out. This is just like a very short little nothing book that I have here.
When did you send this one out?
Did I send it out?
No. It's okay.
So I'll send it out today. Basically, this guy, I think he does a very nice job putting forward this fundamental hakira, you know, what is property? And it's just a pure conceptual question. And he says, well, there are two real mahalchim. You'll see why this is important for our sugya. So there's this, what people call this Blackstonian view. Blackstone wrote this commentary in the laws of England, where he says property is that sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. Like, you know, bilus in its most full-blooded sense. It's like to own a thing is to have the superpower to be the dictator, the dominator of the object, right? That's this Blackstonian conception of property rights. It's a nice formulation. So it's characterized by total dominion. Property is a right of exclusive control, free from anyone else's competing interests. Now, I'm not even sure if you could apply this conception of property to the Achilas Poel Michel Balabais, right? Is the idea here that the Poel would have this full rights over the object? The Gemara already tells us that the Poel doesn't have the right to be Mahav He Boor, Lahamtik bimisika, right? It seems like the Poel's specific rights are much more limited than this. But he's not allowed to do whatever he wants with the thing. But we'll return to that. Then the contrasting view is what this guy calls, Serkin calls, the Hofeldian view. He says, the prominent legal theorist Hofeld argued that people don't have rights to an object in the world. They have rights against each other. So when we talk about property, we're not really talking about rights to things. We're really talking about specific rights that we hold against other people with respect to things. And he says, in a strong form of this claim, property is not about things in the world at all, but instead it consists of a loosely organized bundle of rights that people have against one another with regard to resources in the world. So the claim here is that when Shua says the hakira is whether the poel has property rights or just a use right, that's like a meaningless distinction because we don't know what the specific, when we talk about property, we just mean some bundle of rights. We don't know exactly what comes along with that. I'll send out this other interesting piece that says, the word property is meaningless in today's society unless you specify like what exact incidents of ownership you have that come along with the thing. We talk about our leased cars as our property. We talk about rental homes as property, right? So it's not fee simple absolute, right? It has a very different connotation. So he says over here, I think in a nice formulation, Today, it's commonplace to describe property as a bundle of rights. From this conventional view, property is not a single right. No single attribute determines whether property exists. Instead, property is a more or less loose collection of separately specifiable rights. Typically, it includes a right to exclude, a right to possess or use and to transfer, etc. But one or more sticks in this bundle can be limited or removed and still leave property. So, you know, you could specify the way the property thing looks in all sorts of different ways. So sometimes you could have a right to use without a right to transfer. So for example, at the wedding, right, I have a right to consume the food without a right to transfer it to somebody else. That's a kind of a property right. If I'm a trustee, I might have a right to manage without a right to consume, right? All these kinds of different property relationships can exist. And I think, you know, Cole was very excited about this, but we lost him for now. When you come back to our sugya, I think you see this very much at play, that even within the Man De'amar Michel Shalohu Ochel, it's not going to be anything nearly robust as this Blackstonian conception of property. The halacha is perfectly fine referring to this as Mishalohu Ochel, even though the specific rights that you have in the thing are going to be very limited. We could flesh this out much more. Shua, you have some comments you want to say about this?
I think we need to flesh it out much more, right? Like, I think part of what you're saying, which is admittedly very important, but it's like trivial before the question of Michel Shamayim, right? Like, yes, obviously there's a bundle. Obviously it's not pure dominion in the Blackstonian sense. And so like maybe I spoke too imprecisely when I said like ownership Michelo, because I think the Gemara, again, these are the same Gemaras that talk about Shibudim. Like, it recognizes that there are different types of yeah. pieces of ownership, right? It's not reductive or absolute, but I think when you impose your framework, I don't understand what the Gemara's Hava Mina is. Like, now all of a sudden the words are meaningless. Like, what's the difference?
Well, okay, good. Good. So I want to say the following, Shua. Notice, there are two ways, this is what I'm getting at. There are two ways to understand the Gemara's Hakira, Mishalo and Mishal Shamayim. Yeah. One way, I think, is what Shua's initial stab was, that, well, the Gemara's question is whether this is a property right or something weaker than a property right.
Yeah.
That was Shua's first move. And I'm just saying that, well, depending on how you think about property rights, that may not be a meaningful distinction, right? Because the question of what is a property, just really it's a question of what kind of property right is it, okay? That's where the bundle of sticks thing is helping us. And that makes me wonder whether the Gemara's Chakira might be getting at something different. Meaning, it's not about, is this a property right or not? It's actually about, what is the basis for this entitlement, right? So on what ground is the Poel getting this? And that's really what the question of Mishalo or Mishal Shamayim is. What generates the entitlement? What generates the right? And so if you look here, for example, at Rashi, on Sadi Beis Amar Aleph, Mishalo Hu Ochel, it's a question of, is this Tosefes Schar Shehosifo Lo HaTorah? It works through some mechanism of added compensation for the job. So it's like it's payment for services kind of an idea. Or is the idea that this is gifted through this mechanism of Gemilas Chasadim? So, you know, here it sounds almost like it's not so much about, does this generate a property right, or does it generate something weaker than a property right? We're interested more in, well, what's the conceptual ground for the Poel having this right? Does it flow through this idea of schar? What I think was Gabe was referring earlier to, like, this idea, it's a quasi-contractual, it's part of this payment for services, or is it flow from this very different halachic category of Gemilas Chasadim, similar to Matnos Aniyim, et cetera, et cetera. Shua, does that address the...
No, I mean, I think that's really important. I just think we need to follow it through. Like, you before gave the, you made the point that this ownership is distinct from like whatever the list of things you're not allowed to do. And I think that like you said that in passing, but like working out this Gemara with those dinim is like a little bit more of a lift than just kind of like writing this off, right? Because if you read Rashi here through, what Rashi's saying is the distinction between it being Gemilas Chasadim and it being Tosefes Schar is a distinction about when it's yours, right? Like Rashi seems to be maskim that once you get it, you can do whatever you want with it, right? If it's stucca and I get stucca, there's no restrictions on how I use it. And that seems to be clear here. And that seems to sound like that from Rashi too, right? Like if I pick it and take it with me, I'm not over, first principle, without other halachos coming into play, I'm not like messing anything up, right? Rashi says, and then when it is Matal Yadei, it seems like you can do whatever you want, right? Right. But the Hakira here is about my schos before any action on the thing, right? So that I think is like fundamental. So
right, but then that shows that it's not about do you have an ownership right or non-ownership right. It's almost about when does the right begin, right? From, is it generated by your work? In which case, you, before you even acquire it, before you lay claim to it, you could you have the power to transfer it.
Right.
It would have to be in your rishus first in order for you to transfer it to a third party.
Yeah, right, yeah. I think, yes, which is also just very interesting. But I agree with that.
Good. All right, this is a complicated sugya, as you can tell. But I want to, think more about the Hofeldian framework, the nature of this ownership question, Blackstone versus the Hofeldian incidents. I'll send out that little article, which is really short and helpful. And then I think that'll be helpful for us to tease out a little bit more about what this Michel Shemayim Chakira is. And hopefully that will help us determine, what the nature of this halacha is, this Chos Achilas Pala. All right, Shikoff, let's stop here and we'll pick up with our discussion on Thursday. All right, everyone?
Yes.
Yeah. Got it.